discussing the politics of the new European populism. Pella Neuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome to the Pella Neuroth-Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon. Well, we're broadcasting from Malmo, which is Sweden's third largest city. On the occasion of the Eurovision Song Contest being held here, it's not much of a contest. It's Europe's largest, perhaps the world's largest music cavalcade, and hundreds of millions are expected to tune in on the Saturday for the final, and their semi-finals going all week, and it's turned into a very big media event. And I'm not so, this is not a music program, I'm not so interested in that. I was more interested in highlighting some of the political issues that might result from Israel's participation, and the fact that Malmo is sort of Northern Europe's Marseille. It's received a lot of immigration from all over the world, making the city unrecognizable from earlier decades. And I was talking about those things with earlier guests. To be in fairness, there are people in Malmo who say that the city's become more interesting and dynamic, and interesting restaurants and are not inconvenienced by sort of racial troubles at all. And it was, in some respects, a sort of rather boring working class manufacturing town a couple of decades ago, where the only pleasures would be had by taking the hydrofoil across to Copenhagen in Denmark, which is a 40-minute hydrofoil ride, and drink yourself legless. But anyway, we're going to talk a little bit about that. We've got two excellent guests who, on this local theme, whom I'm interviewed before. Erik Olsson, who's one of Sweden's most distinguished professors of philosophy at Lund University. Lund is a town about 15 minutes drive from Malmo, probably Scandinavia's top university. He's going to tell us about the anti-scientific authoritarian feminism, which he thinks has infiltrated academia. And we've had voices talking about that happening in the US, but Erik's going to talk us through the Scandinavian angle on this. We've got Göran Adamsson, who's an associate professor in sociology, as our final guest today. He's got a PhD from LSC, London School of Economics, and he's written a number of really interesting books about the sort of philosophical and journalistic and make you really think, and I can highly recommend them. Perhaps the best one or best known one is The Trojan Horse, a leftist critique of multiculturalism. So he's attacking multiculturalism from the perspective that usually defends multiculturalism. No, left-wingers ought to be against multiculturalism. That's his argument. And it's one of those thought twisters that you can use, dropping into an argument. He's sometimes been called a Scandinavian Jordan Peterson, and we're looking forward to that chat. So anyway, we're just in Malmo. We've got names like pop groups competing for this prize, names like Baby Lasagna, and we've got one pop singer emerging from an egg on stage, a gigantic egg in his underpants. No, this is not a young svelte woman, it was an overweight Finn. So the Eurovision Song Contest, which used to be very staid and organized and reflected a Europe that was more conservative and attractive in some ways, has become a competition where people try to check all the non-binary boxes and be sort of outrageous and have interesting stage shows. There's one pop singer named after Windows 95 system, for instance, and we'll see how that goes. So there's more to Europe than castles and cathedrals and ancient universities. Some people talk about this transition that we've had from a Europe of the left bank, Europe of Isaac Newton and Jean-Paul Sartre, and fantastic dinners in Paris and in Rome, to becoming this degenerate place, which has lost its identity and whose primary common cultural output is this Eurovision Song Contest. You know, whatever happened to Beethoven, sort of thing. And it's true, I reflected on the fact that we don't know very much about each other in Europe anymore. We don't read each other's novels. And there's a guy called Arnaud Bertrand, who's a very good ex-blogger. And he says, I'm French, but I don't watch French movies and I don't read French books. And France and Germany and Italy have almost no intellectual reach, at least here in Northern Europe, nor in UK. We don't follow their stuff, which happened even 10 or 15 years ago. And the area which I follow, which is geopolitics, the French geopolitical debate is not in advance of the one that's going on in America. The Americans remain the most sophisticated and knowledgeable about the topics that I'm interested in. That's the go-to place. And that's very little in Britain, I'm afraid to say. I mean, lower than their rate of the population compared to the United States. America still has a First Amendment freedom and not afraid to speak. So we've got this thing, and there's an Australian body called the Australian Strategic Policy Institute that looks at 64 critical technologies where, like, you know, I don't know, sort of nanotechnology, nuclear environmental power. I mean, lots of complicated names. I'll give you the link afterwards. But 64 critical technologies which we need to survive, lots of AI-related stuff. Well, China and America are first or second, and every single one of them. Europe gets some third places, but not many. India, incidentally, is doing quite well. So we're falling behind. We've got immigration, we've got wars, we're declining in our innovation. But, okay, we've always got the Eurovision Song Contest. Anyway, this is the Pelle Nerov Taylor Show. This we'll have Basil Valentine on now for more news analysis after a very quick break.
Connecting the dots, painting the bigger picture.
They always have great conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to the show, Pelle Nerov Taylor Show, Basil. So, don't you think the Eurovision Song Contest displays Europe at its very most creative, best, and sophisticated? We're really going to win the 21st century, aren't we?
Well, you know, the long, it's really since the days of ABBA or Sandy Shaw, Puppet on a String, back in the 1960s, Eurovision has become increasingly political, for one thing. Countries seem to vote in favour of their allies and against their traditional enemies. The songs have always been notably cheesy. Most of the people singing them disappear without trace as soon as the event is over, ABBA, of course, being the glorious exception. The whole thing has become bloated in a way that a lot of international competitions do these days, like the World Cup, more and more entrants, you know, more build-up, more lead-in, but that doesn't necessarily improve the quality of the performance at all. A lot of people are asking why Israel is involved in the first place, given that it's not in Europe. And countries between Israel and Europe, geographically, like Lebanon and Syria, are not included. So that's why. And of course, a lot of people saying the Israelis should have been excluded for the same reason as the Russians were, basically murdering lots of innocent civilians. But I think the demise of Europe is rather hastily predicted. It's still the place in the world where everybody wants to be, everybody looks to. You know, Americans still look to Europe for fashion, music, style, and sophistication. And Europe is where all the migrants from Africa and the Middle East are heading. So, you know, for all that, according to some metrics, is falling behind in terms of technology, plus, of course, the tremendous own goals scored with the sanctions on Russia. Nevertheless, it still has the, you know, the history, the geography, the architecture, the cuisine, the culture, and everything else that's the envy of the world, frankly. Now,
You want to carry on?
Well, I was going to talk about something we mentioned last week, which was the dinner between Macron and Xi.
Yeah,
and
okay.
Macron changed the menu. I don't know if you heard about that.
No.
All right. On the second day of Xi's visit, they were having dinner at the Étape du Berger restaurant in the Col du Tourmalet ski resort up in the Pyrenees. Initially, the menu, which was finalized several weeks in advance, featured traditional Pyrenean dishes such as black pork ham, lamb shoulder, porcini mushrooms, and local cheeses. But at the last minute, Macron removed the favored dessert known as the Russian cake, which has historical ties to Russia, and the decision to replace a local speciality with roots dating back to the 1920s and originally made with almonds from Crimea was reportedly made due to the sensitive geopolitical context, and in its stead, a blueberry tart was served as a less politically charged alternative.
Well, that's fun. I just want to pick you up. I'll tell you a little guilty secret I have, which is to look at Quora, which is this website where normal people ask and answer these incredibly. It's my equivalent of doing Vox Pops. Instead of going out and talking to people, I read this. And on the lifestyle question, it's a lot of Europe versus America questions. And I don't know, they're based in California. I don't know if the editors have this point of being as anti-American as possible. I mean, they're American, right? But I can almost never find anything that favors America on that site. So see people say, well, shall I go and live in America? No, the food is disgusting. The supermarkets, they have additives in their food. You can't walk anywhere. The heating is overwhelming. There's no civilization. They think if you speak English, they say, well, you're a native speaker. They say, which state is London in, that sort of thing. And for all these prejudices, I've never met those people on this show, I have to hasten to add. And Europe is wonderful. We've got this wonderful welfare state, and you can walk in cobbled streets and go into little restaurants and things like that. So there is, as you said, if I don't know how representative this is, they're filtering out all the pro-Americans on that show, on that website. But it's all very much bigging up Europe and saying what a fantastic place it is. And if you do take a drive, as I did from Barcelona to Sweden last year, that old Europe still exists to a great extent with yes. Nice old restaurants. When we talk about immigration and all that stuff, not everything, by the way, looks like those streets in Paris where they've set up tents and are defecating on the streets at all. I mean, there's a lot of normality as well.
No, that's right. I'm off to France on Saturday, actually. I'll be broadcasting from there for a couple of weeks, and I fully expect it to be as delightful as it always is. It's as simple as that. President Xi, meanwhile, has gone on to Budapest, where he's been welcomed after a brief stay in Serbia. He's now in the company of Viktor Orban, and it's his final leg. He's there 3 days. It's a state visit, and the visit to Hungary marks 75 years of diplomatic relations between the two countries. State dinner tonight with Viktor Orban.
Yeah. Well,
the reason I'm talking about Xi is that he's there to talk about trade and strengthening ties and building infrastructure and bringing an end to the war in Ukraine and an end to the war in the Middle East, where the Chinese see themselves as peacemakers. And it contrasts sharply with David Cameron, whose speech this morning's warning that the world is more dangerous, volatile, and confrontational than it's been for generations, while he sounded a warning over Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran, coming out with these usual sort of, as you said, SAS language, that Western states need to show courage. If we hesitate, our adversaries, I mean, what adversaries? We have huge trade relations with China. You can't possibly label them an adversary in the current climate. Yeah. If we hesitate, our adversaries will rise in our future for us. So we need to show courage. I mean, what exactly is that supposed to mean?
Exactly.
Arm ourselves to the teeth, start right. World War III. It's such a different vision. The world is only more dangerous, volatile, and confrontational if you choose to see it that way, David Cameron, you know.
So, I mean, how many people are in the SAS? You know, I know they write best-selling novels and they occupy the bestseller lists in the Anglosphere, but I don't know, 500. Let's say there's 500. Are those 500 going to topple the regime in China? Are somebody going to airdrop them over the Forbidden City? You know, what's the plan? You know, Britain doesn't have an aircraft carrier that can put to sea. It's only got these SAS guys and MI6, who, of course, they have a monopoly on briefing these ministers, so they surround them with a worldview that is totally hostile and totally in the service of their escapades, you know? And
depending on the scale of the conflict, warships, period, are obsolete. They can be taken out by missiles fired 5,000 miles away, you know? Yeah. I never saw it coming until it was too late. So, you know, those aircraft carriers, the USS Ronald Reagan and what have you, these enormously expensive bits of hardware. They wouldn't be obsolete if nobody was, you know, attacking them. But if you choose to attack them, you can destroy them from the other side of the planet.
Yeah. Right. So the British aircraft carriers, which run out of fuel or break down and which don't have aircraft, can be still be targeted even if they're floating around in the North Sea and not going anywhere. All in line with, it's just this language that they use.
Literally, I mean, sitting ducks.
That they have, I mean, I guess the Lithuanians, population 3 million, who now want to send in troops to Ukraine, are cheering them on and clapping and good old Britain. But I mean, the rest of the globe, they put themselves so in hock to these East European fanatics, but they don't realize that in India, China, Africa, Brazil, they're looking at with great askance. They didn't support the British. Now the Americans aren't even supporting the British. The Russians, of course, aren't, and the Chinese aren't. You know, they're shaking their heads. And I wonder if Cameron knows this. And he doesn't care.
Oh, you know, it was such a, you know, I'm sorry to say, stupid statement he made this morning. The nations closest to Russia are seeing what is happening in Ukraine and wondering if they will be next. And not far from Europe, war rages in the Middle East as Israel defends itself and tries to bring the hostages home. Innocent citizens in Gaza endure a crisis that will only worsen if aid cannot reach them safely. And all this while there are at least 18 conflicts underway in Africa. But you're not doing anything to bring peace to any of those situations, David, are you? You are fueling the fire of war in Ukraine. You have said you will continue to arm Israel, even if it slaughters tens of thousands more innocent civilians in Gaza. You're not interested in bringing peace there. You know, the feeble words about reaching aid, reaching people getting blown to bits every day. Likewise, Africa, 18 conflicts underway once again. Okay, then why aren't you there trying to solve them? Where's the International Africa Peace Conference? Non-existent.
Yeah, well, it's safe to say that we're not great fans of David Cameron on this show. Okay, thanks a lot, Basil. We will see you tomorrow at the same time. Stick around. And this is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. We're off to our third guest from this Eurovision Song Contest city this afternoon. Thanks a lot, Basil.
Thank you.
Los Angeles has been described as a suburb looking for a city. Join me as we explore LA's neighbourhoods and the local restaurants, cafes and bars that are an integral part of these vibrant and diverse communities.
Today we are going to cook a small steak for people who are really quite hungry.
Very, very simple. A couple squeezes of lemon in there.
Since you're adding the meat, and you can also do it with tofu options as well for the vegetarians.
Olive oil. So now we're going to season it up. Fresh grind black pepper.
Really hot and busy in here.
I'm going to go ahead and make some butter toast.
Olive oil.
Smells good.
Grab our shiitake mushrooms.
Season with salt a little bit.
Boy, it's getting hot in the kitchen. Need another drink of my beer. That's the best part of cooking.
And we are ready to put our plate together.
Add the mussels right around the rim. See, we have really nice colors, nice piece of fish.
We just need to add a little bit of powdered sugar.
And I will just put a little bit of reduction glaze over the top.
When you add a pesto like this onto a braised meat, the smells that just come up are just wonderful. Take it from me, we've got a good thing going here.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
At the top of the hour, we'll keep on top of the news.
It's the most important thing we can do.
On today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show on this Thursday afternoon from Malmo, Sweden, as the country's third largest city. When I came to Sweden a few years ago and started doing documentaries about Sweden, I was doing so because I perceived that the intellectual climate was absolutely terrible for free speech, even though Sweden has very formal great freedoms in what you're allowed to say on paper without being libel, done for libel. But one of the bits of fresh air I got was when I met and talked to, interviewed for my film Sweden Dying to Be Multicultural, and in the its follow-up called Cancel Nation, was Erik Olsson, who got his PhD in theoretical philosophy, an MSc in Applied Computer Science and a BA in Mathematics from Uppsala University in Sweden. He then became a professor at Uppsala and now a full professor at theoretical philosophy at Lund University, which is quite near Malmö, incidentally. He founded a group called Academic Rights Watch, which looked at academic censorship all over the place in Sweden. And he's now developed his theory, which was at its early stages when I interviewed him, which is about the authoritarian nature of academic feminism and how it's hampered free speech and actually reduced freedom at universities, which contributes to what I was talking about in my earlier monologue, which is the decline of Europe in a way. We don't have as good thinkers anymore because we're not so free. Welcome to the show, Erik.
Thank you very much, Pelle. Good to see you again.
Good to see you, yeah. So you from the position of safety, I guess, from a top theoretical philosophy post in Sweden, you've been battling against authoritarian voices all over the universities. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've been doing and what you found out?
Well, I mean, so one thing I'm doing or have been doing for quite some time is monitoring academic freedom in Sweden, as you mentioned, in the framework of the foundation called the Academic Rights Watch. So that's one part of what I do in terms of affecting society and trying to improve things. And then what I'm also working on now, I think we mentioned this last time I saw you, is a forthcoming book, which is called, it translates into The Soft State, The Feminization of Society and Its Consequences. And it will be out now in a couple of weeks, unfortunately in Swedish language for international audience, but we're also working on an English version of that book. So I hope it will come out later this year, in fact. So. And the basic question here is why is this soft value culture or woke culture is spreading so much in Europe, you know, and why we have this decline that you talked about in the Western world today. So it's rather a big topic, but we focus on the case of Sweden because Sweden, as you know, is the most progressive country in the world. So in a sense, it's the country where feminine values have been spreading, more than in other countries. So basically, the book is about explaining the rise of woke culture in some intelligible way, you know, rather than just complaining about it. So why is it that we have this this culture, and why is it so successful in spreading across the world at the present point?
Hmm. What can you give me some concrete examples of the way that the freedom of speech has been hampered? I mean. You cited, that the female personality is less confrontational, basically. And so I think when we've spoken earlier, you've also talked about biological differences, which of course many universities deny, but it's a very real thing. Yeah. Women have evolutionarily less aggressive than men. So that filters into the university system. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So if you look at the woke culture and if you look at the values that are promoted or included in woke culture, you see that they correspond almost one-to-one with the typically female values that have been identified in the psychological research for a very long time. You know, so these are well-known facts in psychological science, you know, so it's and now you see these things. If you look at inclusion, for instance, or gender equality and things like that, these are things that a typical female would think is very attractive and very important values. Whereas a typical male would say, no, if there is a conflict between diversity and things like that and the freedom of speech, I'd rather have freedom of speech. You know, so you have this conflict between female and male values, and it's extremely interesting to look into the literature, the experimental literature on that. And when you do that, you see that again, that the woke culture values are simply typically feminine values. And so the reason why we have woke culture, and this is quite surprising to me, is simply that we have had this demographic change. So we now have a lot of more females in higher positions in society, and the girls are doing much better than boys in school, and this is spreading across the society at the moment. So it's basically a demographic effect So in a sense, it's trivial, but one has to think rather hard to get to the point where one sees this.
We're going to go to a news break in a moment, but I'm going to ask some questions to think about. Is it women are doing better at school? Is it because they're naturally clever, if you like? Is it because the school system has adapted to them and focusing on things that men are not so good at? Or is it that women are finally coming into their own with the burdens of oppression lifted? What can we do? Because we talk a lot about the white male crisis, but we'll talk about those things after the break. We're going to go into the news now and carry on talking about authoritarian feminism with Erik Olsson, a professor at Lund University. This is the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show, back after the break.
Here's what's making news.
TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. President Joe Biden stated that the U.S. will not supply Israel with certain weapons if Israeli forces enter population centers in Rafah, Gaza. This declaration was made during an interview with CNN. The U.S. House of Representatives voted decisively to reject a motion to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson, proposed by Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene. Greene's motion was tabled with bipartisan support, with a vote of 359-43.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth Taylor Show. Well, it's Eurovision week taking place in Sweden, so we've had a cavalcade of guests from this region of Sweden where the festival or the competition is taking place. But we're talking about serious subjects, not the Eurovision thing. Erik Olsson, the professor at Theoretical Philosophy, has written a book about some of the negative effects of feminism in the universities. Why do women do better at school then?
Well, I think we have looked at the situation in the Swedish school, and if you look at the topics that are being taught now, and the way and what is required of students nowadays, it's valued highly are typically female traits or typically female competences. So being good at speaking, and arguing and things like that, and. So it's actually a transformation of the whole school system in a sense that you see. So I would say that the answer to your question is that there is a feminization going on in the school system in terms of the curriculum and the things that are, the way that things are graded, courses are graded and so on. So that's, I think, the main reason why girls are doing better at school nowadays. So it's not the case that women. Had it been the case that females were generally better, it would have always been the case. But now we see this gender gap in the grades, and also if you look at the detailed content of the curriculum, you see that it's actually tailored for female thinking and the typically female traits.
But how do you define? If we're say making the argument that it leads to wokeness and political correctness leads to worse outcomes, in what sense is having a more communicative student body? And is that about? Isn't that good in itself that you have a good people who can argue and talk?
It's a good thing in many cases, But there are also cases and areas of society where you don't want to have people arguing or talking. So you'd want to have. Let's say that you're building a bridge. Surely you want to get the math straight. In that case, you don't have to. Don't want to argue about maths and so on. But if you look at the tests that the students are doing now, it's actually about arguing effects of physics on climate change and things like that. It's not about the actual equations of physics so much, But so that's where I think this is kind of a dangerous development. But surely there are also areas of society where it's very good to have good people who can argue very well and things like that, but I think that one has to be careful here to see to it that we don't lose the basic competencies in maths and physics.
Well, I have to say, I traveled on a train 400 kilometers yesterday evening, and both trains, and I was three trains, all three trains were late and had problems. So is that a visible sign of the decline of engineering in Scandinavia?
Yeah, that's it's something we actually discuss in the book as one of the consequences of this development, where you go from a male society to a more female society. That because of course the trains in Sweden, they are operated by at least the rails are state owned, but the operations are privately owned. But it's if you look at the whole system of transportation, it's actually getting worse all the time. And I think one of the reasons for that is that the competence for that kind of thing, or even interest in technical things, is missing nowadays from the state. You know, so women typically are employed in the state, I should say that, and men typically in Sweden are employed in the private sector. But what happens here is that the interest and the knowledge of technical things are gradually being lost in the state.
So, they're in boss positions and they just can't be persuaded that these things are important, because maybe a lot of engineers, computer scientists, people like that are not maybe good at selling themselves and explaining the importance, and they're not being trained in enough quantities because the whole state is focusing on other female style priorities.
Yeah, you know, we have all these sustainability things that are, to many females are much more interesting than the technical stuff, you know, or promoting gender equality. And there are a lot of soft values that are entering now in Swedish politics and are, implemented at various levels in the state, you know. So it's a lot of attention and energy goes to those things at the expense of the things that the state used to be doing, taking care of basic transportation, seeing to it that the energy is there, you know. So a couple of years ago, we had this energy crisis in Sweden, as you know, so this is also, I think, part of the whole picture here.
Well, I'm quite pro-nuclear, and that was dismissed on just emotional grounds, was it? And we didn't need to have any of these crises if we just invested in nuclear. But let's just set aside sort of talky subjects and focus on engineering and science and maths, where you do need hard logical thinking. Do you think, there's a lot of effort. I used to write for an engineering magazine, and every issue had an article about how we get more women into engineering, and a lot of female editors pushed that relentlessly. Do you think, are there quotas for science and engineering to get more women in? And is that part of the problem, or is it part of the solution?
Well, I think that, there are certainly quotas in Sweden in a sense. So there are, in Academic Rights Watch, we have documented several cases where the universities have tried to get more, female lecturers in these hard subjects and the STEM subjects and so on and so forth. But the main problem here is the lack of interest in from the female side. So women typically aren't, and this is also objectively studied in psychological science, that they aren't typically extremely interested in these subjects simply. And when they are often even more interested in other things. So many women, they take these courses in the STEM sciences, but then they tend to start to work on something completely different after the studies. So it's mainly an interest thing. You know, women are typically interested in human beings and relations and things like that, and men are typically interested in things, you know, technical things, and you know. So everyone who has children of both sexes know this difference, you know, because it's kind of trivial, but it's for some reason disputed in society today.
It's incredible, because this misapprehension goes with this total flaw that goes through the school system. I mean, I talked to one of your colleagues, Professor Madison. He said that when psychology students come to university at the age of 19 or whatever, they do not know, they have not been taught that men and women are biologically and psychologically different, and that has a firm genetic basis. They're not taught those things. They're taught that this discredited blank slate thesis that you can impose what you want, and that's totally poisoned our politics, hasn't it? But men and women are different. Not women aren't worse. They're just different, and that's a biological fact.
Exactly. So, and this is this difference is only statistical in nature. So, of course, it's not about every man and every woman, but it's a kind of statistical irregularities, you know, that are women tend to be in a certain way and men tend to be in another way. And this is as well established in science as climate science. I think it's even more established than climate science, you know, because there are huge studies which we have gone through when writing this book, which show, you can even pinpoint the exact, numbers, you know, how much the difference is between a female traits and male traits and so on. So it's so we only use what's so-called meta studies in our book because we only want to use science which is really established. So we don't refer to separate so individual studies, but to studies that collect other studies and summarize other studies. And when you do that, you see the picture is completely clear, and it's completely well established in those fields. But and yet, as you say, it's not taught at all in school. Rather, the opposite is taught that to be women and men are statistically equal, which is simply false.
Mm. Well, I mean, that's what we try to do on this show. I just try to get the truth out on many things because we're so misinformed and people have such profoundly different, and it's sometimes it's even called conspiracy theory, this idea that men and women are biologically different, or you're assumed people can't confuse fact and emotion. I mean, just because I say that women have a different makeup doesn't mean you dislike women, not at all. You're just stating a fact. Nature doesn't care about your feelings is what I say. You know, you've got to go with the facts.
And in Sweden, we have this cultural tradition of gender equality. You know, so it's I think of this as a cultural blind spot in a sense. You know, so the culture prevents us from seeing the truth in this particular area. And other cultures might have other blind spots. You know, but we have this particular blind spot, and I think many other countries in the world also share this gender blind spot that we simply can't see, or we can't. Argue that or claim that the sexes are different in the psychological sense, but if we don't, there are a lot of things that we won't understand if we don't want to realize that this is the case, you know. So that's the big problem here.
Would you agree that interestingly, whenever there is an article about science or engineering, some clever clogs. Female journalist at Swedish television. She won't actually talk about the issue at hand. She'll say something, but why aren't there more women in this doing this? Mm. And it's the easy question because it makes her look clever and this boring old guy look stupid, you know, and embarrassed. But she's not actually interested in the issue at hand. And she's playing a sneaky game to elevate her and give her some kind of elevated status as some clever woman who's fighting against the patriarchy, when it's a bloody science issue, you know?
Yeah, but it might even be, that she isn't aware of the, or she isn't interested in the technical stuff, you know, because, as I mentioned, women tend to be interested in relations and the human beings and so on. So it's a, might not be, other motivation than that behind it. And so it's simply a, something we see in all these studies that people, it's a different way of being attentive to things in your environment. So women tend to be attentive of human beings in the environment, their relations, what they say to each other, and men see things in the environment. They even see the world somewhat differently.
Exactly. Exactly. So mention 100 things that you see around you, and men and women would give different lists.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's incredible, yeah.
Really fascinating. Yeah.
So do you think that we should stop writing articles about there are not enough women in engineering and just leave men and women to do what they want and follow their preferences? That's not oppression. Yeah. It's allowing nature to take its course.
Yeah.
Women feel bad about not being engineers.
Absolutely. And now that we have, in the Western world, we have very, gender equal societies. So now we can simply let people choose what they want to do, because everyone has the opportunity to choose what they are interested in. But of course, the effect of that will be what they call the gender equality paradox, that people will be choosing very traditionally. So that's a kind of paradox in this area of research. You know, so if you let people choose freely what they want to do, what kind of occupation they want to have, and so on, women will mainly choose female occupations, and male will choose male occupations, and that's fine. And so I don't see any problem.
Your book sounds fantastic, and I shall certainly read it in Swedish. And as you said, it's coming out in English later this year. So Erik Olsson, professor at theoretical philosophy at University of Lund, which is Sweden's top university, has written a book which criticizes a lot of the woke shibboleths and rubbish and BS about feminism and science and so on, and tells it straight. Just give us, for the benefit of our audience, the book's expected title in English so we can search for it.
The Swedish title translates into The Soft State, The Feminization of Society and Its Consequences. But I can't guarantee that this will be the end, the end in the English.
We'll have you on again when the English version comes out, and very much look forward to that. Thank you very much, Erik. Have a good afternoon. And this is the Pelle Nerås-Taylor Show, and we've got our last guest on this Thursday afternoon. It's coming up after the break.
Anticipate potential delays for the morning commute. In other news, a recent government report on prescription drug pricing points to corporate mouth.
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
What are you talking about, man? Look at his stats. Spark sheer
athleticism. It's about your right to be informed. Your right to access all types of information keeps us free as a nation.
No.
Today, there are real threats to press freedom.
Reaching residential areas by...
And your right to know about the world around us.
Look.
Some threats are obvious, some are easy to miss, but they all put our way of life at risk. We must defend against all of these threats, no matter what kind of news is important to you.
Justified putting American troops in harm's way.
That's a great question.
We must protect our right to know before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
I'm Sandra, this is Jorge, and we were adopted in 2019. I remember when they first came to us, Michael was already a teenager. The whole cliche of, they're so lucky to have you guys, and it's the other way around. They have changed our family for the better. They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
Deconstructing PSYOPs, propaganda, and mainstream media garbage. Pelle Nerås-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Nerås-Taylor Show. We're broadcasting here from Malmö, which is Sweden's third largest city because of the Eurovision Song Contest going on. But we're going to talk about more serious issues than that with Göran Adamsson, who has been a lecturer in Malmö, and hence the theme of today is sort of academics and ideas people from this city. But he's an associate professor of sociology, PhD. He was at the LSE in London, and he's written some excellent books that look at the whole immigration, nationalism, multiculturalism from a slightly different angle than we mostly hear. They're very highly original and readable books. And I'd just like to highlight The Trojan Horse, A Leftist Critique of Multiculturalism in the West, which you can find in all the usual places on the internet. He's been called the Jordan Peterson of Sweden after his battles with Swedish academia over censorship issues. Welcome to the show, Göran.
Thank you very much, Pelle. Nice to be here.
So we're going to, I don't know, we're in Malmö now, and I was wondering, your ideas came from, they grew and nurtured in an environment which was, I guess, Malmö University, and your years in Skåne and your meetings and you seeing how Malmö developed from a white working class city with a shipyards into a completely different place. Can you relate your insights there and meeting a lot of left-wing people who didn't seem to have brains? Can you relate that development of Malmö with this Malmö theme today and your thoughts and your books?
Well, thank you, Pelle. This is a topic for like a four-hour lecture, but I can just bring up maybe a few highlights. I remember when I was young, because at the time Malmö was run by Social Democrats like it is today, but at the time the Social Democrats they were sitting in a very nice intimate embrace with the working class in the city and the shipyard industry and so forth. So it was, I would say it was socially very, a very tightly knit community. And but now we've seen a complete shift in many ways. The working class is no longer, you know, on the agenda. It's been marginalized and abused, and the leading social democrats, they have found other groups to idealize and show extreme sympathy towards, and these groups are of course the migrants, and the group which is seen as the most suffering, and the group that one must sympathize with most intensely are of course the Muslims. So now we see a kind of embrace and a very intimate relation between the multicultural left, as I would call them, and migrant groups and Muslims in particular. And that leads us, I would guess, straight into the heart of the Eurovision Song Contest. And so that's a huge problem. And so the lines of demarcation, the lines of, and the so to speak, the connections in Malmö has shifted dramatically over the last 20 years, I would say.
So the hegemonic left-wing Social Democrat Party, was it they lost interest in the working class, maybe because people, as they got richer, they voted for the moderate, the right-wing party, so they lost that tribe in a way, they imported voters in a way, didn't they? Could you say that?
Yes, they lost that tribe, and now they have found a tribe which is even more exotic, even more, you know, far off, even more overseas. And this tribe is no longer Swedish. It has no longer any connection to Swedish culture, identity, history, culture, and so forth. It is a completely alien tribe. And this tribe comes from the Middle East, mostly, I would say. I mean, what I'm saying here, I would say it's not a political opinion. It's like, I would say this is a sociological fact. Mm. This is a fact, because these are the lines of the sympathy these days. So, and I think this is very unfortunate because, for hundreds of reasons. And if you want to keep Malmö and if you want to keep Sweden in general, Swedish, I would say.
Mm. The thing about the old social democrats, though, they were often came from social democrat backgrounds. The leaders were not divorced from their tribe, as it were. They rose out of that movement. And Malmö was the first place where social democracy came from, Germany, I think it was. But these people were quite socially conservative, and they believed in self-improvement. They wanted to join the bourgeoisie, and they believed in academic. They were really bright people, a lot of these guys, and believed in universities. Whereas, isn't that the theory of your book, The Trojan Horse, that now the left doesn't believe in self-improvement anymore? It believes in keeping people, the migrants, in a ghetto of their own culture rather than joining the culture and improving themselves and finding common standards, if you like, to get ahead in life.
That's very true, Pelle. The old Swedish social democratic leaders, they were conservative in the sense that they believed in, you know, a kind of Protestant work ethic. They wanted to improve, and they wanted to join the bourgeoisie, you could even say. They wanted financial progress and better salaries in order to have a better life, in order to gain access to high culture, in order to gain access to literature, opera, you know, and all of these things that were good in life. And now we see a kind of social democratic movements who are looking at migrant groups. And the worst thing would be if these migrant groups would fuse and be a part of Swedish society, because then the social democratic leaders would no longer have a group, this kind of pathetic, marginalized group to idealize. They would no longer have a reason to support them. So I think it is under the surface, I think this is a quite cynical game going on, where the social democrats, they seem to be very keen to make sure that these migrant groups and the Muslims in particular will be left in a state of, at least a seeming state of marginalization. to be able to be exploited by the academic left in Sweden. And this is my theory, and I think this is pretty obvious to see if you take a closer look.
So the academic left are not the good guys. They're using these people for as a sort of, I don't know, guinea pigs or virtue boosters, and they don't really have their clients' interests at heart. That's the whole point, isn't it?
They make a career not by making other people wealthy and autonomous and independent, but by keeping these people in a state of marginalization and poverty. And I think this is going on throughout, not only in Sweden, but maybe clearer in Sweden than anywhere else. But I think this is going on throughout the Western society. A kind of left-wing elite being very happy to have these guinea pigs and these, the poor guys sitting on their shoulders. And they make a career by fueling this this kind of exclusion. Yeah, you know what I mean.
And it's interesting because what you're doing is you're knocking the left off their pedestal, because they're always so superior and they always play this role of talking down to the rest of us. And if we have any other views, now we've got a couple of minutes left. I know that you had much of your career and your upbringing in this part of Sweden, near Malmö, and you were lived in Lund for years. But now you're talking to us from Budapest, which we like the Hungarians on this show, and many of the other hosts big up Hungary and Orbán and so on. What are you saying? What's your message to the Hungarians, and how do they take it? How do they see Sweden and Malmö, for instance?
I'm not talking about the Hungarians in Sweden. We are talking here, there's a conference, and we are talking about, it's actually a kind of dialogue between youngsters and people like myself, and the topic is what's in it for Europe's future, and I would like to bring up maybe Sweden something you need to be careful about, the kind of policy we have adopted in Sweden, because I think that if you need to try to preserve European values, and if you need to try to retain a country and a culture that other people would like to come to and visit and maybe even live in, you really need to stick to a certain number of European inherent values, such as freedom of speech, equality between men and women, and transparent institutions, and a secular state, and all of these things. And I think the bloody irony here is that you have a kind of a multicultural left, and the multicultural left are working very hard to tear down all of these values that they used to fight for or even die for as late as 50 years back. So we have, again, I'm talking about this many times, that we have a kind of an abyss between a classical left, and I have a lot of sympathy for this classical left with intellectual, even bourgeois ambitions for the working class on the one hand, and the multicultural left, who seem to want nothing more than to trash and put an end to Sweden as we know it for the benefit of other cultures. So I think this is something I will talk about the day after tomorrow during the conference.
Well, I was going to say, I've been to Hungary a couple of times, and all my life I've been interested in the post-socialist countries. What was communism really like, and so on? And I was really anti-communist when I was young, but I've got a more nuanced vision. I don't want to just say the word communist and then everyone blows up. Because I say people who grew up in Hungary, they said, you in the West, you don't have communism, you have something else, because our communism actually put talented people through their paces. You know, we had classical culture, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, opera, really good scientists and so on. And then we did a lot of other things badly, but they were actually very, what's the word, meritocratic. And elitist in some ways, you know, they pushed people to the top. So what you have in Europe, Western Europe right now, whatever it is, it's not the communism that we had, and you can't use that label for it. We had many things wrong. We're not communist, but that's, and this sort of, and you have a lot of Any thoughts about that? Because you will be teaching a lot of, or talking to people who are children of ex-communists or people who grew up under communism. We've got 30 seconds left, so you just have to summarize.
I'll keep it very short. I think there are some very unfortunate parallels between Sweden today and, for instance, Poland in the 1950s. Because Sweden, I think, in certain ways is moving very sadly, regrettably moving in the wrong direction towards increasing censorship, towards increasing freedom of speech in academia. So I think it doesn't really bode well for my country, sadly. That's what I would like to say. That's what I'm going to speak about.
Okay, well, look forward to that talk. Göran Adamson, currently in Budapest, but from Malmö, it's Professor of Sociology. Thank you very much. We will talk, we'll wind up today and talk to you more another time. Thanks.